I still can't believe I'm doing this, said Utena Tenjo to her reflection in the mirror. It's a great honor, Caitlin informed her. Maybe so, Utena replied, but I still can't believe I'm doing it. Oh, relax, said Kate, making a dismissive gesture. Dagger disc is almost finished. Corbin only has the boring parts left. Why not? Like I said, it's a great honor. Anyway, they're not what you're expecting. Utena adjusted the Klingon baldric that Subcommander Klang had given her over her Atori Academy jacket, then turned and said, Well, how do I look? Kate gave her a thumbs up. Dangerous, she said. Utena grinned. Wish me luck, then. Good luck. See you tomorrow. You bet. Utena reached into the pocket of her red Martian Army trousers, took out her IPO Space Force communicator, and flipped it open. Tenjo calling Khoskaj, she said.
Khoskaj receiving, replied a gravelly voice. Are you prepared?
Ready as I'll ever be, Utena replied wryly.
Jol Yichu!
The beam swept her up and deposited her in a transporter room. This room was different from the others she'd seen. On Challenger, Enterprise, and Babylon 5, they were all much of a type, large rooms with six pads arranged in a circle on a dais, and a control console facing them some distance away. This was a longer, narrower room with seven pads arranged all in a row along one wall, and the control console jutting from the other. The walls were angled oddly compared to what she was used to, and colored beige instead of the silver or gray of the other starships or B-5. She swallowed, popping her ears. The air here was thicker and warmer, but not uncomfortably so, and the gravity felt slightly heavier. The light was slightly reddish. Standing near the controls were two uniformed Klingon officers and, to Utena's surprise, a human woman who also wore the uniform of the Klingon Imperial Defense Forces. Captain Tenjo, said the smaller of the two Klingons with a broad smile. He was still fairly tall, over 6 feet, but he was the least heavily built Klingon Utena had ever seen, with the least pronounced head ridges. He was actually kind of handsome for a Klingon, with mischievous eyes and his beard neatly plaited. I am Captain Krontap Vath Kesek. The speaking Klingon went on. He saluted her, fist across chest, bowed, and said, Welcome aboard the battlecruiser Khoskaj. He indicated the woman. My first officer, Commander Jamie Finney Kalkesek.
Pleased to meet you, Captain, said she, nodding. I've heard so much about you.
And my second officer, Subcommander Zarg Tholik, Krontep went on, indicating the other, bigger Klingon. This one was scowling, as Klingons often did, and though he said he was charmed, Utena rather seriously doubted it.
She wondered at the executive officer's name. The prefixes designating family relationships among Klingons were complicated, and Professor Krolik didn't really start teaching them until his senior classes, which Utena was a long way from, if indeed she ever had a chance to continue her education with the professor. She thought, though, that Kal indicated a marriage name. That was unusual.
This is the one who defeated the great Krolik Vestai Kalan in honorable battle? Zarg rumbled. She's nothing but a child.
Utena felt her ears getting hot. She'd anticipated being challenged, of course. It was a common thing among Klingons, but she hadn't expected it to happen in the transporter room 20 seconds after arriving.
Zarg, the Sutai Tenjo is our guest, said Krontep. Do you insult the guests of our ship now?
No, Captain, that's all right, said Utena. Approaching Zarg, she kept her eyes level on his, even though that meant looking up a considerable distance, and asked him cordially, Has the one never learned that one should not judge a batleth by its scabbard? Zarg's considerable eyebrows meshed into a single V-shaped unibrow beneath his heavily ridged forehead.
Perhaps the Vistai Kalan has diminished since his days in the Empire, he said, unperturbed.
Perhaps, Utrinna allowed. Even if he has, though, at least the Vistai Kalan isn't a blowhard. Krontep smothered something that sounded very like a laugh, then held out a hand and splayed it across Zarg's chest as the bigger Klingon started to take a step toward Utrinna.
Zarg, he said sharply. You earned that one. Accept it as your due. My guests are not to be challenged. Is that understood?
Zarg's scowl deepened further. He stared down his captain's outstretched arm into his face for several seconds, then said stiffly,
May the one return to his duties, Captain.
Krontep nodded.
Dismissed.
Without another word, Zarg pivoted on his heel and marched from the transporter room. Finny shook her head. I'm so glad we're getting rid of that stiff, she said.
So is he, Krontep replied with a smile.
To Utrinna's puzzled look, he said,
Zarg and I have been shipmates for years, ever since we were assigned to the Wedge Defense Force Exchange Program in 2387. Every month since that assignment began, he has requested a transfer. Every month it has been denied. Last month it was finally accepted. He leaves us in 2 weeks to take up his new position as the Empire's representative aboard Babylon 5.
Utrinna looked impressed. He's so desperate to leave this ship that he's looking forward to a transfer into the diplomatic corps?
I know, said Krontep, nodding. It's sad.
They left the transporter room, moving into the corridors, and as Krontep led the way, he went on,
Zarg Thalak is in many ways an admirable man. He is the soul of honor. He is courage itself. He is named for 3 great heroes of the Empire. Zarg the Well-Remembered, Thalak the Undeniably Mighty, and Zarg Thalak, the Butcher of Klinzai Prime. And he strives to live up to their example in all things. The only problems with him are that he's lousy at Klinja, and he has absolutely no sense of humor.
And you have to have a sense of humor to survive on this ship, Finny said with a grin. That's why we're out here instead of defending the Empire. Klingon ship designers didn't seem to have much use for turbo lifts. They rode from the ship's main body to the command pod on what amounted to a moving sidewalk, an escalator without steps, inside the boom. As they went, Krontep gave Utrinna a quick history of his command. As it happened, the Hoskaj had been in commission for only a little more than a year. Before then, Krontep and most of his officers had been on loan to the WDF as part of an outreach exchange program, where they had served under the legendary Commander Derek Bacon on the Burrell-class escort WDF Tom Servo, MST-3000. When Bacon had been promoted to captain and reassigned to the WDF Headquarters Division, the Servo's Klingon crew had returned to the Empire, where the High Command quickly realized that they had to do something with them, and fast. They were all famous heroes, returning from their exploits with the humans covered in glory, but their time with Bacon had made them strange. Certain traditions begun aboard the Servo slowly spread through the Klingon fleet, disseminated by the WDF ship's scattered crew. The High Command began to fear a radical change in the Navy's culture, and possibly that of the Empire itself, and they weren't really sure the Klingon people were ready for it. So they did the only thing they could do. They gathered the heroes of the Servo together and put them all on one ship, along with most of the warriors most severely contaminated by their odd ideas. The total had come to 160, which was enough to crew one of the newest, most modern, best automated D-7M cruisers. And for the command of that vessel, the natural choice was Krontep Vathkesek. Once that was accomplished, the safety of the Navy's culture was further guaranteed by sending the ship far away, to a place where it could continue to achieve fame and accrue glory for the Klingon Empire without actually touching the Empire, the IPO's newly formed Space Force, which was grateful for the help.
And so, said Krontep cheerily as they got off the moving walkway and approached the heavy double door at the end of the boom, here we are.
The door, Utrinna was somewhat puzzled to see, had a large, diamond-shaped yellow sign attached to it,
an ordinary highway sign such as were seen on Earth, Avalon, and a thousand worlds in between. In large black standard letters it declared, "Caution! Bridge may be icy." A moment later, she realized where the doors must lead and started laughing. "A souvenir," said Krontep cheerfully, "from the patrol partner of my last ship." He slapped the activator, and the three of them entered a stairwell which took them up to the bridge. "Captain on the bridge," barked the deck officer in Klingonese as he shot from the center chair. "As you were," said Krontep. "My friends, we have a singular honor today. This is Captain Utena Tenjo of the IPO Space Force Reserve, a good friend of the Epitai Hutchins and his eldest daughter, one of the famed band who bearded the Earther Psycor in their very den, and a favored pupil of the great Kral Gvistai Kalan. She will be joining us for our patrol circuit today. Her command of the warrior's tongue is somewhat shaky. She has only been studying it for 9 standard months, so while she is aboard, we will use standard, unless she speaks to us first in Klingon Hol." "Kai the Sutai Tenjo," said the deck officer. "Welcome to the Khoskaj." Krontep introduced Utena to his bridge crew, which was smaller than those of the other ships she'd seen, only 4 aside from the captain and his exec, 1 manning helm and weapons, 1 engineer, a sensor operator, and a communications expert. She tried to commit their names to memory. The helmsman, who had been acting as deck officer, was Koth. "I am Koth. Koth of the Vengeance," immediately rolled through her head. The engineer, Azrodel. The sensor chief, Vorek, almost sounded like a Vulcan name. And the comm operator, Krentai. Utena looked around, wondering where she should sit, as Jamie Finney took her place in the exec seat, to the right of and slightly behind the center seat. Krontep didn't move toward that seat, though. Instead, he went to the jump seat to its left, where Utena had just decided she was supposed to sit. She looked at him, puzzled. "The ship is yours, Captain," said Krontep expansively, gesturing to the center seat. Utena felt her face stiffen with surprise. She leaned down and murmured so that the rest of the crew couldn't hear, "That's nice of you, Captain, but I'm not..." "The Klingon Empire has no such restrictions on its vessels," Krontep replied softly, anticipating her concern. "I am the captain. I could place the Epitai Hutchins' beagle in command if I wanted to. Besides, this is a routine patrol. I will be right here to your left, and Jamie to your right. If anything goes seriously wrong, we will step in. You need fear nothing." "Griffin put you up to this," said Utena, feeling the smile growing on her face. "Didn't he?" Krontep grinned. "He told me he thought if you once tasted command, you'd never rest until you had it back." "Well, I guess we'll see," she said. She went to the captain's chair, paused for a moment, then sat. The chair was considerately designed so that a person wearing a sword on either side could sit comfortably without removing it. She took a moment to familiarize herself with the displays and controls on the arms. She felt a little silly. The chair was designed for a much bigger person. It made her feel like when she was 4 and climbed up into her father's favorite armchair, one of the few dim memories she had of anything related to her parents. Utena cleared her throat, looked at the viewer, and said, "Communications, get me Babylon 5 control."
"On screen, Jahli,"
said Krentai, and Susan Ivanova's very surprised face appeared on the main viewer. "Imperial Klingon cruiser Khoskaj requests clearance to depart on patrol," said Utena. Ivanova blinked at her, blinked again, then seemed to realize that she should be doing something.
"You're clear to depart, Khoskaj," she said, and then added, as if out of habit, good hunting."
"Thank you, B-5," Utena replied, unable to keep the grin on her face from blooming into a full-fledged smirk at Ivanova's surprise. "Khoskaj out." She made a small gesture to her right, and just as if he'd been working for her his whole career, Krentai cut the channel. "Helm, lay in a standard patrol route, full impulse power," said Utena.
"Course laid in, Captain," replied Koth.
Utina considered her next move for a moment, then smiled and delivered Koth of the Vengeance's signature command.
"Action!"
Koth of the Khoskaj grinned broadly and replied,
"Acting!"
The good ship, Powerful, winged away from B-5 and commenced its patrol. Corwin Ravenhair wasn't having nearly as much fun. He was almost finished with the repairs to his father's ship, and all the stuff that an assistant could be of any real use for was done. That part he had enjoyed. It had been hard work, but somehow even hard work didn't seem like it when Utina was around. She hadn't been exaggerating. She was a fast learner, and by this point Corwin suspected she was better with a plasma cutter than he was. She could calibrate shield generator nodes with the best of them, too. Now, though, all that was left were the fiddly, irritating, mostly electronic jobs, connecting the calibrated nodes into the overall generator network, calibrating the new communications array, running loopback tests, boring stuff. He sat back in the pilot's seat and sighed.
"Sounds like somebody's got something on his mind," said a voice behind him. He turned to see his mother entering the cockpit. She was dressed for work, in a gray coverall similar to his own, but cleaner, since she hadn't been working on the ship all week.
"Hi, Mom," he said, and went back to working on the comm tests.
"That's it? Hi, Mom?" And in such a disconsolate tone, too.
She slid into the co-pilot seat and scruffled his hair.
"Come on, it can't be that bad. From the outside, it looks like you're almost done. Is there really that much calibration left to do?"
"Not really," Corwin replied. "I was just thinking about something else."
"Ah," said Skuld, her eyes twinkling.
"Before he left with the Enterprise, Nall told me about what he said. He's really very sorry for teasing you that way. He didn't understand until he saw your face how seriously you're taking it."
"Yeah," said Corwin.
He poked at a couple of controls.
"Can we not talk about this, please?"
"No, Corwin, I think it's important that we do talk about it. It's an important thing in your life. I think we should discuss it, at least a little."
"There's nothing to discuss," Corwin replied, manually tracking the dish through its full range of motion. "She's engaged."
"Oh? To whom?"
"Somebody back where she comes from," said Corwin. "I'm surprised Aunt Belle didn't tell you. I'm pretty sure she knows."
"She told me Utina was trying to figure out a way back home to keep a promise to a friend," said Skuld. "I had no idea it was that sort of promise. Do you think it'd be betraying a trust to tell me more about it?"
Corwin put down the diagnostic pad, looked across the cockpit for a few moments, and said,
"You're my mother. I can trust you with anything I know."
And he told her everything he'd learned the previous Saturday, after he and Utina had left the spring formal, before he'd taken her to the moon. When he finished, he added as a rather bleak postscript, "So, you see, there's not much to talk about," and went back to work.
Skuld sat and thought about it for a moment, then reached across the cockpit, took the pad out of his hands, and put it down on the instrument panel, before taking his hands in hers.
"It sounds to me as if you might be oversimplifying the situation a bit," she said.
Corwin gave her a look.
"It doesn't get much simpler than it is," he replied.
"Doesn't it? Your father's married, you know, but not to me."
"That was different."
"Was it so? The Ragnarok brought us together. What did they call the one who brought Utina and her fiancé together? The end of the world? I don't have to tell you how that translates."
"Don't be silly, Mom. That's not a metaphor. It's just a stupid title."
"Titles in magic are rarely stupid," Skuld replied, "though they sometimes appear that way. Listen, I'm not saying it'll be an easy thing, or a quick thing, or even that it's definitely possible. I'm not your Aunt Erd, who can recognize these things at a glance. All I'm telling you is that I've seen the way she looks at you, and I don't think you should write yourself off just yet." She has unfinished business to attend to, and she may not understand herself that more than she foresees is possible, but it is, and she's smart enough, perceptive enough, and centered enough to realize it one day." Skuld smiled and patted Corwin's cheek. "You're growing up so fast, son, but you're still so very young. You have time. If you do love her, then don't give up. Don't push. That'll only drive her away. But never give up. Hold on to that love. Keep it safe. Stand by her. Help her finish what's been left undone, if you can. And when it's all said and done, who knows what might happen? Do you know how long I loved your father before I had a chance to do anything about it? How many times I gave up hope, only to discover that hope still remained?" "I should," Corwin replied wanly. "You've only told me about a million times." Skuld gave him a good-natured swat. "Don't take that tone with your mother, young man," she said with mock severity. Then her expression softened, and she took his hands again and said, "Did any of that get through?" "I think so," said Corwin. He smiled, less wanly, and said, "She's asked me to help her get her master's certificate this summer." "Are you going to?" asked Skuld. "Of course," he replied, unhesitating. Skuld smiled, her eyes gleaming, and she pulled him into an embrace. "My little knight," she said, running her hand through his thick black hair. "Brave and true." "Mom," said Corwin. "Shh," Skuld replied. "You're growing up so fast," she repeated. "It won't be long before you slip away from me forever. You're already so independent." "You raised me that way," Corwin said in mild protest. "I know," said Skuld, her voice hoarse. "And it makes me so proud to see you standing tall and making your own choices. But sometimes I wish I could have that little boy who was, forever." She backed off, sniffling, and wiped at her tears. "Pretty stupid, huh?" she said, smiling through the tears. "She who builds tomorrow, wishing she could hang on to yesterday." Corwin smiled and drew her back in. "I'll always be your son, Mom," he said. They held that tableau for a few minutes, then Skuld sat back again, wiping at her eyes one more time, and said, "I almost forgot. Poor girl, I've left her waiting all this time. I came to tell you that a friend of yours from school is here with your homework for the week. Your teachers excused your absence because of the circumstances, but because it's so close to the end of the year, you have to do the work. She's up in the observation lounge. You go ahead and get at your homework. I'll finish this up. We won't tell your father," she added with a mischievous grin. "Somebody brought it by hand? Couldn't they have just transmitted it?" "They could," said Skuld with a smile, "but your classmate is a stickler for form." That, and the female pronoun, told Corwin who it was before he'd even started to splash water on his face, wash his hands, and leave the docking bay. He reached the observation lounge and had his suspicions confirmed. "Hey, Fu," he said as he entered. Fu Hooji turned and smiled at him. "Mr. Corwin," she said. For the first half of the 2404-2405 school year, the lab team he belonged to in Mr. Sulak's 8th grade physical sciences class had been Corwin, Nall, and Buttercup. The young god, the talking cat, and the Utonium sister most commonly believed to be the most dangerous of the three. Bets had been placed as to how long it would take the three of them to destroy Mr. Sulak's lab, but they had proven to be a surprisingly effective team. Their experiments didn't explode, and sometimes they even worked correctly. With the mind-bogglingly complex experiments Mr. Sulak classified as simple, this was about par for the course. A student from Division 7A had been promoted to the advanced science course following Christmas break. In order to even out the number of hands with actual thumbs present in the Corwin-Nall-Buttercup team, Mr. Sulak had assigned Fu Hooji to their table. Before that point, Corwin hadn't known Fu well enough to remember her full name. She was a year younger than he was, a year behind him in school, and at New Year's he only knew her to say hey to in the hall. But then he knew most everybody at Crescent Heights Middle School to say hey to in the hall. He knew of her, though. Everyone in the school had heard of her. She was widely reputed to be the smartest student in the Heights, and it was no hollow rumor. Her intellect had impressed Mr. Sulak enough that the Vulcan had permitted her, an underclasswoman, to join his advanced sciences class, which most eighth graders didn't make the cut for. She'd pretty well proven that to Corwin's satisfaction. Table 3's success rate had increased dramatically since she'd joined their team. Sometimes she had insights that startled Corwin, and that, given his family, wasn't exactly easy. He liked her quite a bit, not in that way, but as an intellectual partner and a good person to hang around with. She reminded him a bit of Kala, which was sometimes painful, but also good. And here she was, in her green and white school uniform, presenting him with a daunting amount of homework, then blunting the blow by helping him to complete it. They monopolized the corner table in the B5 OBS lounge for most of the afternoon. "I saw the film of your rescue flight on the news," said Fu as Corwin plowed through another chapter in his history text. "It looked quite exciting. I'm glad no one was injured." "Hmm," said Corwin. Fu didn't take offense that he was distracted. He was supposed to be distracted. He was doing homework. Anyway, she knew his working patterns well enough by now to know that he was still listening. "Where's Mr. Knoll?" she wondered. That was another thing about Fu that was kind of odd, but endearing at the same time. She was always very formal and respectful, even when, as with Knoll, the situation didn't really call for it. Knoll had once joked that if he had been one of the dragons of myth, the maiden-devouring kind, Fu would have very politely objected, "Please don't devour me, Mr. Dragon." Fu had replied primly that courtesy was perhaps of greatest importance in just such a situation. "He sort of adopted one of Captain Picard's officers," said Corwin. "They went off to chart the Denorios belt. Should be back tomorrow." "What a pity," said Fu. "I must return to New Avalon tonight. I would like to meet Captain Picard. I've heard a great deal about him, and hear about their survey. The Denorios belt is a subject of particular interest to me." Every subject seemed to be a subject of particular interest to Fu. Corwin let that pass with a smile. Instead, he asked, "How'd you get here so fast? Dad let you use the Stargate?" "I don't think you're supposed to discuss that in public, Mr. Corwin," Fu cautioned him. Corwin looked around. "We're the only ones here. Anyway, the B5 staff know about it. It is installed on their station, after all." "Still," said Fu. Then she relented. "Yes, he did. It was quite a remarkable experience. I'd very much like to talk to Dr. Petrarca about his research into it at some point. I find alien artifacts, particularly those which are relics of lost civilizations, very fascinating." "Hmm," said Corwin. "Too bad you have to go back. Kate's trial for master is tomorrow. You could help out." "I don't think my skills would be of much use in such a trial," Fu replied with a smile. "Katsujin Kenryu has archery counters," said Corwin. Then he shrugged. "But you're probably right. There's going to be a lot of people watching. Dad probably wouldn't want arrows flying around the dojo. Might hit somebody whose injury would be hard to explain. Like Captain Picard." "Perish the thought," said Fu. Corwin finished his work at 6. They had dinner with Kate, Jury, and the several other duelists who could be found. And then Fu said her, very polite, goodbyes and returned to New Avalon. Challenger returned that evening, whereupon Griffin convened them all in one of B5's big conference rooms to tell them that he would have news to announce the following day, after Kate's trial. That was all he would say, which left several of them rather exasperated, but not too seriously. His glee at whatever it was he had to tell them was infectious, even if they didn't know what the hell it was. Caitlin was reflecting on exactly that as she sat in the living room of the Green Sector suite she called home for the moment, polishing her Zatoichi. She should have been preparing herself, mentally and spiritually, for the trial she faced the next day, and indeed she was for the most part, but some portion of her mind insisted on wandering off and pondering her father's plans, futile though the endeavor was. She glanced down at her Institute Duelist's ring and wondered if it meant anything anymore. She hoped it did, or at least that it would again soon, but given the state the place had been in when she'd last seen it, the odds didn't seem very good. The door chime sang its little song. Kate looked up from her work, puzzled, then glanced across the room at Jury, who shrugged faintly. Kate put her blade and maintenance gear aside, got up, padded to the door in pajamas, robe, and slippers, and keyed it open. There, much to Kate's surprise, stood Liza Broadbank. After her encounter with Sionji aboard the Core shuttle, Liza had gone back to her rooms on Red 12, showered, and gone to sleep. When she woke, it was evening, and she'd taken a long, hot bath while considering her next move. In retrospect, it was the obvious one. She'd combed her hair, put on the fluffy robe that came with the room, and here she was. Caitlin visibly mastered her surprise, then kept her face and voice neutral as she said, Liza? Caitlin, said Liza, her own voice and manner subdued. May I come in for a moment? Kate gave her a curious, appraising look, then stepped back. Suit yourself, she said, gesturing to the room. Liza entered, and as the bulkhead closed behind her, she absorbed another look of calm appraisal from Juri Arisugawa, who then closed the book she'd been reading, got up, and excused herself. You don't have to go on my account, said Liza. This will only take a few minutes. Juri looked uncertain. Kate gave her a small nod, and she resumed her seat. She didn't go back to reading, though. Instead, the redhead sat, legs crossed at the knee, and regarded Liza with cool wariness. Kate stood where she was with a, well, sort of expression. I was raised, said Liza slowly, to hate you, Caitlin. From the earliest time I can remember, my parents taught me that you and your family were the enemy. All I ever wanted was to make my father happy. And if I could do that by making your life hell, then that was what I was going to do, and I was never going to look back. Kate nodded, her face still neutral. So here I am, said Liza. 16 years on, having pursued that end with all my might, used all the guile and cunning that growing up Broadbank could give me, and where do we stand? You, the wrong one, the shy one, my nemesis, have friends who risk their lives for you. And me? I don't even have my family, because my stupid, vengeful act caused such tension between Zeta Cygni and Earth, my father has disowned me, cut off my allowance, deactivated my credit line, revoked my security access to the house and the apartment downtown, everything. I'm cast out. Jury said nothing, did nothing, but her eyes made it plain that she thought that was just too awful for words. Really. Kate, on the other hand, shifted away from her look of neutrality toward something different. At one time, Liza would have seen it as pity and flown into a rage. But after the experiences of the last few days, she realized that there was a difference between pity and compassion. Caitlin was moved, sincerely moved, by the plight of her oldest enemy. It was enough to make Liza want to cut her own throat. Say, some part of her thought wryly, why didn't I think of that yesterday? That's not what I came here to tell you, the blonde said, shaking her head, irritated with herself for digressing. I didn't come to fish for sympathy. I came to say... Liza paused, looking down at the carpet. She took a couple of deep, steadying breaths. Then she raised her eyes to Kate's again and said, I'm sorry, Caitlin. I was wrong. I've always been wrong. The problem was never you. She chuckled bitterly. Mary, my youngest sister, She's understood that from the start. I could never figure out how she could be so stupid as to befriend your little sister and her twin, but now I realize that I'm this stupid one. Kate looked at her in silence for a moment. Then she smiled ever so faintly and asked, "What does that make Clarissa?" For it was well known that Clarissa Broadbank, the middle sister, was, if anything, more ruthless, more cruel, and more all-around vicious than Liza had ever been. Liza let out a short, low-mirth laugh. "That makes her Daddy's new favorite," she said. "Maybe that's for the best," said Kate. "Maybe. Anyway, that's all. I don't expect you to accept my apology. I've done things I know I would never forgive. But it was important to me to offer it. Good night." Liza went to the bulkhead door, keyed it open, and was about to step outside when she noticed that Kate was at her elbow. "What?" she asked, not haughtily, for perhaps the first time in Kate's experience, but with genuine puzzlement. "Let me get you some tea, said Kate. "I think we have more to talk about." Liza stood gazing thoughtfully at her old nemesis for a few moments, then nodded. The airspace around Babylon 5 became pretty crowded, considering the place wasn't even open for business yet, on Saturday morning. First, the Khoskaj returned from patrol and disembarked its special guest with an invitation from Captain Krontep for everybody, duelists, station command staff, Challenger and Enterprise officers, to dine aboard that evening following Kate's trial. Then the Enterprise arrived, fresh from remapping the Denorios belt. At noontime, the Vengeance emerged from the Metagate, the scorches on her armor and blackened deposits around her weapons ports, silent testament to her activities since departing. Amanda, Devlin, and Rena beamed back to the station and joined the others for lunch. They didn't talk about where they'd been or what they'd done, only informed their friends that they had been successful, and left it at that. The others didn't pry. Before they knew it, it was time for Caitlin's trial.